Hello and welcome to the Shepherd Walwyn podcast series. My name is Jonathan Brown. Shepherd Walwyn is a campaigning book publisher based in London, England. Our purpose is to uncover and promote new ideas to society's oldest problems. And whilst our specialty is ethical economics, something Anthony Werner, our driving force for over 40 years, has pioneered, we have branched out over the years to other related areas such as the environment and the lives and works of society's change agents. These podcasts promote ideas we're convinced can actually help us build a better society for all of us. So have a listen and be sure to share with your friends if you like them, but also tell us what you think. These are debates we all need to be part of. So without further ado, let's get into the interview. My guest today is Akhil Patel, author of The Secret Wealth Advantage, How You Can Profit from Economy's Hidden Cycle. Now, regular listeners and friends of Shepherd Walwyn will recognise Akhil as the Director of Property Share Market Economics, along with Phil Anderson, teaching subscribers how to remember the future. Akhil has professional experience both in the UK civil service and in international development and business. He's worked on a range of issues, from reviewing large infrastructure deals to helping establish the UK's International Climate Fund. Akhil has two master's degrees, both in finance and public policy, and also a first-class honours degree in classics from Oxford. Akhil, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So I think everyone at Shepherd Walwyn and our community are very excited about this book. And I know I was lucky enough to have a sneak peek of it. I just wonder if you could take us through what prompted you to write it.
I mean, the book builds very much on Phil's Secret Life of Real Estate and Banking, and also all the other greats of the Georgist movement, like Fred Harrison, many of the works published by Shepherd Walwyn. But when I came to think about, you know, what might be a gap, it was a question, so what? We have all this insight about the 18-year cycle, really well documented by Fred and Phil in particular. But I thought, you know, as a reader, what do I do with this knowledge? And so I wanted to provide that. And then the other thing is, there's so much insight in some ways. I wanted there to be a single place where you can go for a distillation of, you know, how the cycle moves through each of its stages, you know, what is it about, what's going on at any point in the land market, in the stock market, and in other places. And so that's why I created the book. In addition to that, I also thought there are some explanations about the fundamental laws of economics that need to be refreshed and brought up to date in a way. And so I'm trying to do that as well. For example, law of economic rent and how it applies in the digital economy is one area.
And I know you start the book with the question from Her Majesty the Queen when she went to LSE after the last crash and said, why did no one see it coming?
Yeah. I mean, it's a question that we were all asking in some ways. Maybe we didn't articulate it in quite that way. Maybe we didn't have the opportunity to pose it to some of the top academics in the country. But what I really loved about that story, in addition to the fact it was the Queen and people were duty bound to respond once she asked it, was that it's always the simplest questions which in some ways the hardest to answer. And of course she got a response some months later, and it was, I mean, you know, there was some pretty good elements about it, but it didn't get to the heart of the matter. And so I think most people are none the wiser.
No, and I know the book, The Secret Wealth Advantage, How to Profit from the Economy's Hidden Order. It's that hidden order that you've articulated so clearly, isn't it, really, that would have answered the question for the Queen had she still been here?
Yeah, and, you know, she never really made any comments about things like this, but she was on the throne since 1952. So she would have seen downturns in the early 70s, in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, and then 2008. So I'm sure she must have had some kind of view of her own about these things. She didn't say, well, that's a load of tosh. Thanks, but load of tosh. It really would have been quite interesting, because one of the reasons why the cycle persists, I think, why it's hidden, I mean, well, there's probably a number of reasons. I articulate the fact that the fundamental law of economics is not really well known. But the other reason is that, you know, each time a new cycle comes around, the people who are in power or making decisions or in senior management in the previous cycle have moved on. And so, you know, you don't have the benefit of that experience. And the Queen, I mean, of course, she's a figurehead in, or she was a figurehead in many ways, but she did have the opportunity to witness events. She'd been briefed by government ministers and so on. And so I'm sure she had some kind of view about what's going on. Unfortunately, we'll never know what that is.
Mm. Yeah. So could you just share with us, because I think we've all got our own stories about how we find our way to the likes of Fred Harrison and Phil Anderson, and it usually involves quite a considerable amount of pain for ourselves or our families. Yeah. I just wondered if you could share with us just a little bit about your story, about what prompted you to become interested in these alternative views in economics.
I mean, in some ways, the pain is also part of my story, but it's not the only part. I mean, the very immediate kind of point was in 2009, my family's business went through a very difficult time, and that was caused by banks calling in the loans. And they do that in a crisis, particularly from small businesses, because small businesses don't have the ability to say no. And it creates huge amount of a huge number of problems. My family's business is in pharmaceutical wholesaling. It's not an industry that really goes down when there's a recession, because, you know, people still have health issues and need medicine. So there was no real reason for the bank to call in loans, but they do because they need to sort out problems elsewhere. And I thought, well, you know, this is such a devastating episode for us. We had a lot of problems at the time. We can't keep going through this. We need to be prepared for the next episode. Now, that's the sort of the reason why I went on this journey. It was around the same time I came across Phil's book. But the longer picture was, actually, I was very fortunate when I was at school to come across the work of Henry George. One morning in assembly, someone read out a passage from Henry George, The Unbounded Savannah, which he's describing the settling of the American frontier. And he describes how land increases in value as, you know, this little frontier village becomes a town, and as the town becomes a city. It's a very poignant picture. And so when I became interested in economics after I graduated from university, I have a degree in classics. I went back to Henry George. I saw that, you know, there is a cycle, it's to do with the land market. Henry George then led me to Fred Harrison. So I had an inkling that there is a regular cycle of 18 years. And then when the crisis hit, I thought, of course, people are going to be talking about this, because, you know, I could remember as a teenager the difficulties in the early 90s, which was 18 years before. And so I was expecting the commentary to be a bit more informed, but of course it wasn't, because no one understands the cycle. And so put the two things together, having some idea that there is a cycle and seeing my family's business go through problems led me to really want to delve into this and try and create some practical information for my family and for other families like ours, so that next time it happened, we'd be prepared.
So what is your take on the cycle then?
I mean, it repeats like clockwork. So I suppose in some ways I became interested in the detail at the start of the present cycle around 2010. And, you know, I've amassed some knowledge based upon my reading of Phil and Fred and, you know, other greats like Mason Gaffney, Fred Fulvari, Michael Hudson and others. And in Phil's book, he creates a property clock, and, you know, you get sort of insights from places like that, you know, all of which I've tried to kind of distill and put into my book. And given those, you've since 2010, we've just sort of ticked them off one by one. So the cycle repeats, even though this is a very different era to the previous one, you know, very low interest rates, enormous technological change. The location of economic power is decidedly shifted from the West to the East, and so on. And yet the cycle is repeating. That's the ultimate take. Where we are now, the current cycle started around 2010, 2011, 2012. There's never any one day when it starts. We had the mid-cycle recession, as you would expect, some years in, probably started around 2018. That's when the global economy was slowing. So you know, 2018, late 2018, early 2019. Of course, it was exacerbated by the pandemic in 2020. We had enormous stimulus, we had a very short recession, and then we were away again into the second half of the expansion. And it's now a global cycle, and there's a global land boom going on. The news in Western countries is a bit negative at the moment because of Ukraine, because of the fallout from all the stimulus that we had. But there's very much a global construction boom, as you would expect. I expect that to intensify over the next year or two, and we'll see some really outlandish speculative behavior into the peak, which is expected to be around 2026.
Do you have a take on to what extent the West, and I guess in particular the UK and Australia, for a lot of our listeners at Shepherd Walwyn, if the land boom is going to pass us by to some extent and it's going to be concentrated in Asia, or we're going to get some or part of it, what's your take on that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So it's the case that you know, some countries experience more of a land boom than others. And a good example from the last cycle was Japan didn't have an enormous boom because it had such a big crash in the early 90s. I mean, it had an enormous boom in the 80s, massive crash, took them 20 years to sort things out in a way. Whereas America had a, you know, crazy boom. It's quite possible that the UK and Australia, which had very strong sort of period in the 2000s, might, and also being quite affected by, you know, what's going on with inflation and so on. And in the UK, we have the specific additional issue of Brexit and other things. We're quite exposed to supply chains being broken because, you know, we're reliant on a lot of imports. So yeah, it might sort of mean that the boom is not quite as big as we experienced in the 2000s. It's a possibility, but nonetheless, house prices are really high and they've increased enormously over the last 2 years, even though maybe over the last few months they've come down a touch because of the very significant rise in interest rates and people being a bit scared and pausing major decisions. There's still a lot of building going on. I mean, the cranes all over London and in other cities like Manchester and so on. So I think there's an element of the news not really reflecting the reality, but it's also possible that we don't get quite as big a boom as we would because we have some issues that we're trying to work through and that affects our economy a bit more than others. And I think similarly in Australia, though I'm not quite as close to the property markets outside of sort of Sydney and Melbourne, you know, there are some adjustments to be made because everyone had got used to such low interest rates and so on. And it's creating some issues. But nonetheless, when commodity prices come back, as I'm expecting to do for various reasons, including another cycle that I outline in the book, Australia, you know, might well experience a pretty intense couple of years into the peak. Look, there's quite a lot to say about the response to the pandemic. You know, whenever you get a recession, businesses close. I mean, that's just how the capitalist economy works. And, you know, a number of, you know, eating places and other businesses didn't make it back, even though they had support and so on. When things opened, they could no longer really run a profitable business. And so they closed, which meant that what was remaining was there's probably slightly less competition than before. Businesses were able to raise prices. We had enormous levels of savings, partly because of the stimulus, partly because of the lower costs. And also we had this, I think, the sort of mentality that we've been denied our ability to go out. So we're going to go out and spend and see our friends and do all that. And so the combination of additional money, the mindset that we're going to go out, lower competition and higher prices has meant that those that survived have recovered their profits. They're full. You know, you can't go to top restaurants without having to book weeks in advance and so on. And that is kind of feeding into this idea that there's quite a lot of inflation. Now, I don't expect it to keep going, but I'm just saying that is probably the, in some ways you could say the positive side of the pandemic. And yet the the news is all kind of negative. Now, I'm not saying that people aren't facing very significant issues. They are, and they're a combination of factors, particularly if, you know, a large chunk of what you spend a week is on food. And there's been so much disruption on the food supply chain, partly because of Brexit, partly because of other things, that, I mean, it's really causing a lot of pain for people. But just as a general point, we're sort of really, really kind of focusing on the negative side of things, whereas actually we came out of the pandemic, businesses that thought they were totally ruined are able to recover quite adequately. People are still able to spend, and that's kind of keeping this part of the economy going. Then on top of that, once offices and other things have worked out what the new economy will look like in terms of where people locate, where businesses will locate, you know, there's a lot of building in those areas. And so that construction then goes on top of that. Construction employs a lot of people that, you know, feeds into kind of more spending in the economy, and you get the sort of growth and it builds on itself and you get a repeat of the cycle. For maybe the starting point was totally different to the last cycle, but you see how it kind of feeds into the same process again, and you get the repeat of the cycle, which is the point I think I ultimately try to make in the book, is that, you know, there's lots of different routes to the ultimate end goal, which is a repeat of the cycle. And it's just quite interesting how, if you look at the full history as documented by Phil and by Fred, that it somehow just comes in and repeats, because it's linked to the fundamental laws of economics.
Yeah, brilliant. So who is the book aimed at?
There's two main audiences. The really prime one are people, you know, who are sort of, they realize that the world that's being explained to them is not quite right. They're looking for answers and they want good ideas on how to manage their sort of financial affairs, so investments and sort of big business decisions. So they already have an inkling that there's a gap in their understanding and they want to fill it. And a lot of those sorts of people are those who subscribe to property share market economics, which is the business that I run with Phil. But I did try to make the book quite readable, you know, illustrate each stage of the cycle with a different sort of story, try to really explain in very simple terms the major kind of laws of economics, how banking and money fits in, how public spending fits in, commodities and other things. Because ultimately, everyone is affected by the cycle, and everyone has, during the course of an 18-year span, going to have to make some pretty important decisions about when to buy their place, where to locate, you know, business decisions. Do I expand now? Do I borrow, et cetera, et cetera? And so really, ultimately, the second audience is everyone on the planet. Now, realistically, there's not going to be a copy on every bookshelf in the world, but I really have tried to broaden access to this of knowledge as far as possible, because we're all affected by the cycle.
I think that the way in which you simplify the work of, as you say, that the Shepherd Walwin canon, really, of the likes of Fred and even Phil's work, really, as readable as that is, I've not come across anything that offers an introduction, not much bigger than a snapshot, but much less than the I mean, some chapters I can see you summarizing three or four books in one chapter. And I think that's absolutely fantastic. So as an introduction to all the ideas that we've focused on in this podcast, I think it's fantastic. I also, as well, I just think the way in which you end each chapter with a what to do now section, which obviously for the first part of the cycle, then that's already gone. So now we're heading into the craziest time. Mm-hmm. And in potentially where you can make the most money, and also where you can lose the most money. So exactly. I wonder if you could just give us some ideas of the kind of stuff in the book that you'd say to help people to maximize income in the next few years, and then also prepare for what is likely to be an enormous crash.
Yeah. So I mean, thanks for sort of setting that out. Yes, each chapter does finish with some practical action. So we're in the land boom phase. There's a lot of construction. It's still possible to get some decent kind of property You know, if you focus on good locations, don't overpay, which is actually very easy to do when there's a lot of competition in the marketplace for places and so on. There are, you know, the stock market is an obvious place. It's usually rising into the peak, led by commodity, banking, construction, house building stocks. And also, as I point out, for the equivalent phase of this cycle, the land boom, there's usually a industry at the center of the land boom. It might not necessarily be specifically property related, but it draws in a lot of investment and creates this sort of sense of euphoria, which then means that people are doing lots and lots of investing all over the place. And so you can be, you know, you can invest in that. Then it starts to intensify. You get really outlandish speculation. And that's the point where you need to start to be careful. You need to not put any more money into the market. You need to build up your savings. You maybe go into safer things like government bonds, which as the cycle gets to a peak, we'll start to see, you know, pretty high interest rates. I mean, we're there at the moment, but I think interest rates might come down a bit before going back up again. And so you're preparing, and you're preparing firstly so that you don't have to really be too negatively affected by the crash that inevitably comes at the end of the cycle. So that gives you peace of mind. But secondly, having cash and liquid assets and safe assets gives you what, you know, investors call optionality. So when you get really cheap assets, when property market has crashed and the stock market has crashed, you can deploy some of that capital back in and at much lower prices. Because the point is, when things seem gloomiest, when you seem least inclined to make investments, is the best time to be doing so. And so being safe, not having been bruised by the crash, and having the ability to do so is really key.
And I think that a point you make, that there's still time to make quite considerable investments. And at the moment as well, given that house prices in the UK certainly have dropped off somewhat, and whilst the commentators are saying it's going to be a, you know, big recession, blah, 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 what we know from the cycle is that that's not going to happen, but it's a great time to buy because there isn't the competition right now. So, but there's still time. You think if we're in 2023, you've got a couple of years to do something quite significant before you need to get to safety. Mm. So, you know, great point with that. And I think with your book, I think there's going to be a, you know, people can make more money, but do it in a safer way. And I think that was certainly my insight coming into, and what I wanted to do in this next cycle is to not put my family at risk from anything that I did. And your book certainly makes that a lot easier to do.
Yeah, that, I mean, that's the idea. And I think the key point about the crash is you mustn't be a forced seller. So, and you'll be a forced seller because you've borrowed too much and the bank has called in the loans. I mean, that's typically the reason. And so you're forced to sell what you can, not what you want to. And what you can is basically the best of your assets. And so then you're left at the end of the crash with nothing, or with still owing money to the bank and so on, very high interest rates and other things. So I think that's really the key point. It almost is the only really essential thing for the next few years, because even if you were to say buy a house right at the top of the market, like a house that you're living in, you know, it may well go down quite substantially in value for a few years, but you're living there. And as long as you can afford to pay the mortgage and you've, you know, done all that sort of, you've made sure that you haven't overborrowed and other things, you can ride it out. But if you've overdone it and you're forced to sell, you'll have to sell at a lower price, you'll lose a lot of equity and so on. And that's when it really creates problems. So, you know, I think there are some pretty important lessons which are actually quite straightforward, but you just need to understand the timing, the dynamics of the cycle and be prepared. I think that's really the essence of the next few years. I wanted to add about the first few chapters, which are about the start of the cycle and so on. So yes, they have passed us in the current cycle, but when I was writing the practical actions, I was actually trying to think how will it look in the 2030s when we get to the start of the next cycle. And, you know, someone reading it 10 years from now, what do they need to do? So I tried to future proof it. Obviously, I have no idea what the world will look like. I don't know if we'll be taking flying taxis to work in, you know, the middle of Scotland or something. And, you know, there won't be dollars and pounds. They'll just be in a global digital crypto based currency. Who knows? You know, everyone will be learning Mandarin at school and so on. I don't know. But I think the fundamental principles will be the same. And that's what I've tried to articulate throughout.
And I think that's it's a really important point. And when you look at the very best investors, or the ones in charge, is that they make the most money during a crash. And that's the best investors set themselves up for the next cycle in that crash. And I think that's having that kind of thinking, like you, as you say, getting yourself, making sure you're safe, not having to, you know, force any asset sales, but actually being in a position to buy distressed assets yourself at a very good price, that again would really set you up for the next cycle, wouldn't it? Exactly, yeah. As you describe in the books.
Yeah, exactly.
Sorry, the book. So I'm aware of how long this book took you to bring together. So I'm guessing that there isn't another book immediately on the horizon. So where are you and where are you spending your time? What are you doing right now?
Yes, there's no immediate plans to begin writing another one. The immediate plan, though, is to try and bring the insights to a different format. So there are a couple of chapters I think would make for a really good podcast series or documentary. And so I'm going to turn my attention to doing that and see where it takes me. I have no illusions about my ability to create something along those lines, but it'll be fun to try. And then as we've explained, it's getting to really the key points of the cycle. So the other focus is really making sure that our property share market economics subscribers are well set. They have all the information they need to navigate the next few years. Because, you know, ultimately, even though all the insights are in the book and elsewhere, when you're confronted by the reality of the everyday news, you know, the negativity, which we've talked about, the new developments, and so on, it actually is quite difficult to really kind of separate the sort of everyday fluff from the underlying forces. I find it difficult, and I've been studying this for many years. And so, you know, people who are not so familiar with the cycle, they need some assistance. So I'm very much focused on making sure that our subscribers have what they need to navigate the next few years.
So people can obviously buy the book.
Yep.
And where else can they connect with you, find out more?
Well, the best thing to do if they're not familiar with PSE, Property Share Market Economics, is to go to the website and sign up for the free newsletter, which is called the Property Cycle Investor. And they get a weekly update on kind of our take on where things are, some new developments and so on. We've recently done a piece on AI and how that fits in. So that will give them a sense of how the cycle is building. Of course, if they want to have a more insight, more detailed analysis, they can upgrade to one of the other subscription tiers. And the main membership is where they get our full annual stock market forecast and ideas on what to do with particular sectors and investing and so on.
And what's the address for that?
It's www.propertysharemarketeconomics.com.
Brilliant. Well, Akil, congratulations.
Thank you.
If any book deserves to be successful in this space, then it's yours. And both from a personal point of view, having known you for a long time and knowing what a great guy you are, but also when I read the book, seeing and being able to tell just how much work this has taken to express such complex things so clearly and concisely. It's great work. Very good, mate.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Shepherd Walwyn podcast. To explore these ideas further, be sure to visit our website, www.shepherdwalwyn.com, and join our mailing list for news and special offers. Check out our authors and buy the books to learn more. And you can also find us on social media. Links are also on the website. And if you like the podcast, please head over to iTunes or Spotify to give us a review. It's surprisingly helpful in getting the ideas out there. So until next time, keep reading.